Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on pain management.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for tuning in again. Today, we're going to be talking about buprenorphine, so we'll get into it. All right, so I want to thank my colleague Kyle, who's off camera here, but he helped with putting the material together, and he'll be here to also correct me for anything that I say wrong. So Kyle and I both have had a lot of experience with buprenorphine. As you soon are going to learn, this is a five-star medication. So we're going to talk about buprenorphine and its pharmacology. And we're really going to really just touch on the pharmacology of buprenorphine. It's a quite complex of a medication. We'll talk about the pharmacology, and that will help us understand how we can best use it for our patients in hospice and palliative care. And we'll hopefully get through some patient scenarios as well. So when we think about buprenorphine, I'm sure there's some things come to your mind. So I want to start off by asking, when you hear a buprenorphine, what's the first thing you think of? So, first thing, addiction. Common as well. What else? Microdosing. So some individuals think microdosing. We have a fan favorite already, which is great. All right. Chronic pain. Awesome. So buprenorphine is a medication that up until recently, when individuals, both patients and families as practitioners, most oftentimes elicit very strong feelings or emotions. Think about buprenorphine naloxone for addiction, opioid use disorder, right? And then usually you would get some individuals say, well, it can be used for pain, which is accurate. So thinking about now, what is your experience level with buprenorphine, either for pain management or for opioid use disorder? Was your comfort level using it as an analgesic? Maybe even for dyspnea. So hopefully, after today, and after my colleague Kyle has a grand rounds within a few weeks, after hearing that, you're going to start to feel more comfortable. But I will tell you, due to its unique pharmacology, it's a medication that does require getting used to. So just out of interest, how many of you, by show of hands, have written for buprenorphine for pain? So that would be a couple of our attending physicians in the room, but of our learners have yet to do that. I would hope by the end of the year, all of you have raised your hands. All right, so if we think about buprenorphine, getting in some of the basics, we know that buprenorphine is an opioid analgesic. It was originally developed for pain management. There's a really interesting history buprenorphine has. If you have some time, I would suggest you kind of read into it and where it came from. We don't have time to get into it, but it has a really interesting history. That's for sure. It can also be used for management of supervised withdrawal as well as for medication-assisted treatment in opioid use disorder. One of the advantages of buprenorphine is it is a control 3 substance. Okay? So if we think about that, if you're managing pain for individuals who are in a home care setting, what can we do with a control 3 substance? We can, one, call it in, and we can add refills. So it's convenient. So we'll talk a little bit through the pharmacology as to why it is a control 3 substance. Okay? Again, like all of our medications in hospice and palliative care, it comes in a lot of dosage forms that's advantageous to us. It comes in a transdermal patch formulation, a buccal formulation. Both those are approved for pain. Okay? We also have other formulations. We have IV that is also used for pain management. Other formulations that are used that were originally developed for and used for opioid use disorder. The sublingual formulation, the tablet and films, were initially approved in the management of opioid use disorder, that we do use them for pain management. So again, a little more about the background. I think we can all appreciate pain is complex. We all realize that when we're managing, particularly folks who have palliative and hospice care needs, that pain management goes so much more than beyond than just treating the physical components of their pain syndrome, right? Pain often has a strong emotional component to it. So that's going to be important for us to keep in mind as we think about buprenorphine's pharmacology and how it might give us some additional benefits. So as we recognize for complex, difficult-to-treat pain, particularly moderate to severe nociceptive pain, opioids are often a very good option consideration. They're oftentimes a first-line option for moderate to severe nociceptive pain. So we know with opioids, they're quite effective. But we also know when you're dealing with something that's very effective, we have to worry about side effects, right? And I like to think about opioids and side effects in general in two different buckets. We have our everyday side effects, right? That's the drowsiness, the dizziness, the constipation, the nausea, vomiting, right? Those are things that we anticipate will occur in many of our patients due to the mechanism of action of opioids. What we'll see with buprenorphine, due to its mechanism, patients often experience less of those everyday side effects, except for maybe nausea is one where it may be pretty similar to full agonist opioids. Then we have our side effects that we consider to be very rare, thankfully, but very, very serious side effects. And that's respiratory depression with opioids, then our hyperalgesia and neurotoxicity, right? Not common, but very significant adverse effects. Again, when we think about buprenorphine, it offers advantage in those situations as well. Then abuse potential, we look at it potentially has mechanisms that contribute to being abused less. Though the reality is, buprenorphine is, last time Kyle and I did an evaluation, buprenorphine had the highest second value on the streets of any opioid. So we do want to be aware of that. But buprenorphine is an attractive option because it does help to minimize some of the things we've just talked about. Again, it is a five-star medication. All right? Or we might call it a five-tool medication if we were thinking about our sports analogies. You're looking for some articles to read. This was probably the first real article within palliative care that brought it to our attention. Dr. Mel R. Davis is a palliative care physician who's been practicing for a very long time, very well known, very well respected. In fact, this was the article that first brought it to my attention back in 2012. Okay. So good place to start. If you're looking for an article to read, to learn more about buprenorphine, this is a good one. We also have articles that I can send you. So at the end of this email, there will be email address. We have other articles that can also be good starting places for buprenorphine. Okay. So if you think about pharmacology, this is where the rubber meets the road with buprenorphine. Okay, and there are things that we want to think about and spend more time on. Very generically, if you go and you read in textbooks, yes, textbooks still do exist, right? You go read in a textbook, what you will see is it says buprenorphine is a partial mu agonist with kappa antagonist properties. Okay? That's still true, all right, but what we've learned about that is it's very different. It's a lot more complex than that. So buprenorphine does have very unique mu receptor activity. All right. So with this mechanism on that mu receptor, we see that really affect the way we think about how buprenorphine is used. Classically, we used to think that buprenorphine was associated with a ceiling effect. That ceiling effect went both ways, both for efficacy as well as safety. So we would think that buprenorphine, yes, maybe it has some pain properties, but you reach a ceiling effect that really minimizes its ability to use it in hospice and palliative care. That might not be to what you've thought of. For respiratory depression and ceiling effect, we do appreciate that there is a relative ceiling effect for respiratory depression and buprenorphine. So, How does that happen? When we look at the way buprenorphine acts, again, it's a partial agonist at the mu receptor. Okay, that's just part of the pharmacology. If you look more into it, there's controversy in whether it's due to it being a 6-trans membrane mu receptor agonist. There's thoughts about maybe where buprenorphine does and does not bind to within the central nervous system. Are there subtype of receptors that it is preferential for? Does it affect certain parts of those receptors that have downstream effects that full agonists don't affect for respiratory depression? So it's really complex. But what we appreciate is you do see appreciable pain response, and you do see a ceiling effect for respiratory depression in likely pain, okay? But it's at very, very high doses. We also recognize that buprenorphine has a very high affinity for opioid receptors. Very high affinity. Okay, in fact, stronger than almost all commercially available opioids. That's an important point. Okay, important point worth repeating. It has a higher affinity than almost all commercially available opioids. So you should be thinking, what does that mean to me when I'm thinking about it's being used? Okay, so if you hear that point, it's stronger, has a much higher affinity for the receptor than almost any opioid. What does that mean to you? So there is a potential risk for withdrawal. So if an individual is already on opioids, whether therapeutic or illicit, and you give them buprenorphine at a high enough dose, it will absolutely preferentially bind to the opioid receptor, displacing the full agonist opioid and putting at risk for withdrawal. Okay? That also being said, guess what? It has a higher binding affinity than naloxone. Okay? So I know the wheels are turning, right? Has a higher binding affinity than naloxone. So at worst, what I like to say is naloxone and buprenorphine will compete with one another. So if an individual overdoses on buprenorphine, I say overdoses in air quotes on buprenorphine, pretty hard to do. It can be done. How you treat them is very different. It's very difficult because naloxone, our typical antidote, will not be nearly as effective for buprenorphine as other opioids. Okay? And then the slow dissociation rate, meaning it's going to be around a lot longer. In fact, its high affinity and its slow dissociation rate explain why you achieve meaningful pain responses at very low drug concentrations. So high affinity and slow dissociation rate from the receptor explains why you get meaningful pain response at low doses. Now, when buprenorphine binds to the receptor, it has a super high affinity, it is believed to have low intrinsic activity, meaning low intensity of the actual response on the receptor. Now, that is, again, a little bit controversial. There are some studies that show in vitro that show that buprenorphine elicits as a strong of response to some of our traditional full agonist opioids. So this idea that it has a ceiling response, again, we're kind of beginning to question that from a pain perspective. Okay? So a little more with pharmacology, so we'll go through all of these. All right, so each of these, we talked about the partial mu agonist. So the where buprenorphine binds to the mu receptor, this is what makes it helpful for that moderate to severe nociceptive pain. No different than any other opioid. So beneficial for moderate to severe nociceptive pain. Again, this idea that it might have some sort of partial response to having low intrinsic activity, that's where we might begin to believe at doses of 16 milligrams and above. Okay, so high doses utilized for opioid disorder above 16 milligrams, we're pretty cautious to believe we'll get any additional bang for our buck if you increase the dose. Okay, so anything below 16 milligrams of buprenorphine, particularly if we're talking about the sublingual formulations, we realize you can increase dose and probably see meaningful increase in pain response. Above 16 milligrams, we don't have enough experience to suggest that you're going to get a meaningful response. We will occasionally go from 16 to 24, but we're learning a lot more. My guess is if I re-record this lecture in 4 or 5 years, I might have something different to say. Okay, but we just don't know right now. Now, you classically hear of buprenorphine being thought of as a kappa opioid antagonist. Some will think of it as a kappa opioid inverse agonist. So my colleagues get really defensive when I bring up the word inverse opioid agonist. Okay, so if you're hanging out at high field at all and you're around my colleagues, just be ready for a very different response. But what we appreciate, it has a unique mechanism at the kappa. So if we're going to say it's a kappa antagonist or inverse agonist, regardless, what we know happens when it binds to that receptor is you get some type of antidepressant response, antidepressant effect. Okay? How clinically meaningful it is, we just don't know. We know kappa receptor antagonists and inverse agonists are being studied in other areas of the world with medications for resistant depression. Okay? We also know that kappa antagonist, inverse agonist activity explains why we have some anti-hyperalgesic properties. Okay? So you see hyperalgesia develop less with buprenorphine than other full agonist opioids, and in fact may actually have some anti-hyperalgesic properties. Okay? The other property that kappa gives us is when you antagonize it or inverse agonist, you have decreased craving for opioids. Right? So thinking back to our complex pain syndrome, right? You've got an individual who has new onset cancer, reasons to have physical pain, really significant pain syndromes. But we all recognize that individual also is probably dealing with anxiety and emotional distress. We give them a full agonist opioid, say hydromorphone, oxycodone, right? We give that opioid to them, and we give them the right dose. What's that patient going to tell us? Boy, that opioid is hitting the mu receptor. I'm feeling a decreased pain perception through both my ascending and descending pain pathways. Two thumbs up. Right? If they do that, I'm really going to wonder what's happening, right? Probably being punked by somebody. But what we recognize, yes, opioids, full agonist opioids, they modify mu, they do modify the ascending descending pathway. They also modify other pathways, neurotransmitters, to help them feel some level of relaxation. I dare not say euphoria. Some patients do get euphoria. Okay? But more often than not, they get that idea of just relaxation. And if we don't do a good job of educating pain relief from relaxation, again, those are properties that are going to happen. Relaxation is something that modulates those other pathways. You develop tolerance to very, very quickly. So what's going to happen when they see you in a couple weeks? Doc, my pain is not as well controlled. What do we do? We're good clinicians, good doctors, nurse practitioners. What do? We increase the dose, right? So they have this improved pain response. So patients get unintentionally dependent upon that relaxation property. Again, not talking about florid euphoria and addiction. We're getting these bad cycles. I used to call that copioiding. Okay, many years ago I had this term and I wanted it to be what was used. We call that copioiding with opioids or copioiding. We now call it, the appropriate medical term is non-medical use of opioids, right? Most patients do that unintentionally. Boy, this opioid really helps me sleep. I'm going to take it to help sleep. This opioid helps me relax. So buprenorphine has much less tendency to do that. And that might be through part of that kappa antagonist property. So less of that secondary benefit, less of the craving. So in your patients who are at high risk, this might be an opioid to consider using. This opioid receptor-like 1 agonist activity is quite complex. Okay, we don't have really time to get into that today. We know the ORL1 agonist activity likely contributes to the response to buprenorphine, though we really don't appreciate exactly how much and how. Okay, So just if you happen to see a multiple choice questionnaire that asks you if there are mechanisms of benefit, this is one that would be correct. Okay? All right. That would be my hint as somebody who teaches as well. All right? So sodium channel blockade. So where else have we learned about sodium channel blockade as a mechanism for pain relief? So as we think about the best class of agents for neuropathic pain, that would be our tricyclic antidepressants, right? Not really the best. Well, I think they're the best, but there are a lot of good options for neuropathic pain, okay? But tricyclic antidepressants, several of them, one that we tend to use at Ohio State a lot is disopramine, also has sodium channel blockade. Some of our older anticonvulsants that you think about using for neuropathic pain also block sodium channel. So sodium channel blockade properties also contribute to what we believe to be some of the soft neuropathic benefits from buprenorphine. Okay? Buprenorphine might have some soft neuropathic benefits, and the sodium channel blockade contributes to that. Finally, buprenorphine has chaperone and ligand effects. So we've talked about full agonist opioids and how they contribute when you're used at high doses and or chronically to central sensitization. The idea of central sensitization, hyperalgesia, and allodynia. So chronic opioids, what happens is what you see is an internalization of the mu receptors. Okay? The internalization of the mu receptors, so you have less of them to be available, contributes to that central sensitization process. Buprenorphine has much less of that internalization. In fact, buprenorphine may actually increase mu receptor at the level. So you see, we call this the chaperone ligand effect. You may see more receptors because of buprenorphine, but it definitely causes a lot less of the internalization. That explains why when patients are on high doses of buprenorphine that you use for opioid use disorder, say 8 milligrams twice a day, and when you look at some of the data from the opioid use disorder world, and you see receptor occupancy. So dose and receptor occupancy matter with buprenorphine. So when patients are on doses of 16 milligrams, there are approximately 90%, if not more, opioid receptors occupied by buprenorphine. So people have always theorized, well, then you can't treat breakthrough pain if they're on those high doses of buprenorphine. But experience has taught us you can effectively treat with a full agonist opioid breakthrough pain on patients on 16 milligrams of buprenorphine a day. And this idea that the reality is buprenorphine is contributing to increased exposure of the mu receptor through the chaperone ligand effect. Okay. So summary of the pharmacology is a partial agonist, right? It binds the mu receptor, and it contributes to that moderate, severe, nociceptive pain response that we see with all other opioids. It does have a ceiling effect on respiratory depression. Okay, and what's important with this bullet point is this. At low doses, you do not appreciate that benefit. For most patients on low-dose full agonist opioids, right, you see this dose response curve, right? Increasing doses, increasing efficacy, increased side effects. Most patients aren't at risk for developing respiratory depression at low to moderate doses of opioids. But what we see, and we have some studies that have shown us this, as you increase doses, you see increasing response to buprenorphine as well as full agonist opioids. Okay, so you see that predictable dose response curve. What happens with buprenorphine at higher doses with the respiratory depression, you see full agonist opioids, it mirrors that. Okay? But with buprenorphine, the respiratory depression effect levels off. So at higher doses, due to the pharmacology, you see less of your respiratory depression. Now, if you go adding CNS depressants on board, that risk is still there. There might be a benefit to buprenorphine over full agonist opioids. We believe there is. We can't say we've got a lot of data to back it up. But that respiratory depression effect, again, you're going to realize that at higher doses. Okay? You have a decreased incidence of side effects such as constipation. Again, nausea might be the one that there's not a difference to. Decreased risk of physical dependence. We've talked about that some as well, and that can be managed. Now, that's not saying you can just stop buprenorphine. There's no risk for withdrawal. Patients will withdraw from buprenorphine. And if you, I can tell you, if you're working with patients who have found their own way to manage their pain or other conditions, which is quite common, they will be deathly afraid of buprenorphine withdrawal. Their experience is they utilize, they get buprenorphine from other mechanisms, they have a supply for an amount of time, and that supply dries up, and they go through pretty bad withdrawals. Okay, so they can still develop dependency and withdrawal syndromes. All right, so more pharmacology review. Again, it's an inverse agonist. I have to add that on here, at least one for you to see. Potentially kappa antagonist. Contributes to these effects we've talked about. Okay, so anti-hyperalgesic, anti-craving activity, as well as antidepressant effects. So that kappa antagonist activity is meaningful. May also be why we see decreased sedation with buprenorphine as well. So one of the niches you'll see us use this for, that patient who comes in, they're oftentimes, but not always, they're oftentimes older, geriatric in nature. They have a new onset pain, reason to have pain. They're going to have chronic pain. You give them oxycodone or two, man, it really helps their pain, but they're just wiped out. Like Tylenol's not working, NSAIDs aren't working, or we can't give it to them. You give them some full agonist opioids, it works well, but it just really wiped them out. We'll slap a Butrans patch on them, which is a transdermal formulation. Their pain's controlled, they have less side effects, and they are happy, happy, happy. Okay, so you see that decreased sedation be a meaningful benefit for sure. All right, so buprenorphine when it's metabolized. We're going to hit some highlights from that as well. We know buprenorphine is heavily metabolized through the liver. Starts off going through our typical metabolic pathway, going through the CYP system. And then it's quickly conjugated as well. So buprenorphine goes through, goes through the liver. It's metabolized through our CYP system and then quickly conjugated. Norbuprenorphine, several metabolites are formed, but norbuprenorphine is the one that grabs our attention. That's the one that we worry about the most. Okay, we'll talk a little more a bit about that in the next slide as well. It's metabolized by CYP3A4, though we do recognize, compared to some of our other medications or opioids, buprenorphine has less of a risk of pharmacokinetic drug interactions. And pharmacokinetic drug interactions are due to our CYP interactions, right? So we have less interactions than maybe some other opioids. That's a benefit as well. So we think about, again, norbuprenorphine. Again, this is, it's very important. We're going to hit it twice, right? So it is the most important. The reason it's important is it is a mu receptor agonist, okay? It will bind to the mu receptor and elicit a response. But we recognize the pain properties for norbuprenorphine, is less than a parent compound. So it will bind to the mu receptor, norbuprenorphine will, possibly even stronger than buprenorphine. But it has less analgesic properties. So that's a downside, right? That's why we worry about norbuprenorphine. Possibly stronger than the parent compound, definitely has less analgesia. What we also appreciate with norbuprenorphine is that it has some side effects. It contributes to some of the side effects we worry about. It contributes to constipation, respiratory depression that we see with buprenorphine. Okay, but when we look at norbuprenorphine, thankfully, it does not readily cross the blood-brain barrier. So yes, it's there. Yes, it's present. But because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier as well, it can't really contribute to clinical response for adverse effects. Okay. All right. As we think about the way it's broken down and excreted, it helps understand why it's also going to be a benefit, or it's going to be safe to use in renal impairment, not a benefit of buprenorphine. Okay. It is metabolized and excreted through the feces, mainly, and also some through the kidneys and through the urine as well. Okay, so norbuprenorphine does not accumulate that much in renal failure. Again, that norbuprenorphine is what we worry about. So metabolized through feces, as well as excreted through feces, and some through the urine. So what we know is buprenorphine has very, very poor oral bioavailability, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So as you're thinking about, if you're using mechanisms to kind of track or monitor somebody who's on buprenorphine, say you're in drug screen reports or you're in drug screens, you're very mindful that it has poor oral absorption and that its primary excretion pathway is through areas other than the urine, a.k.a. it can be hard to find in urine drug screens. Okay. Again, uremia can be associated with reduced CR3 activity and less buprenorphine formation. So again, safe to use. Again, I'm not going to say it's like any opioids. You know, again, we have safer options, but we still got to use caution, right? Thinking about then liver impairment. Again, when we think about buprenorphine as a singular product, it's a safer option to consider than other medications, other opioids. Okay. It's broken down by the liver, but it goes through both phase 1 and phase 2 metabolism. Okay, that means it has multiple different ways to get metabolized. So what the package insert tells us is for child A and B, it does not impair clearance, and it's relatively safe to consider. Okay. Now, as we think about severe hepatic impairment, there's not a lot of data that really guides us for anything when it comes to opioids or a lot of medications, to be honest with you. So we take caution with buprenorphine, but still consideration. What we do also appreciate is with the sublingual formulation, you do see intrahepatic recirculation. Okay, so we've got to be aware of that as well. What worries us, though, is when you combine buprenorphine with naloxone in the Suboxone formulation and other formulations as well. Naloxone concentration can increase. There's one study that shows it can increase 500 to 1,000 fold in hepatic impairment. So if somebody has hepatic impairment, we do not combine naloxone with buprenorphine. We give them a buprenorphine product only. Because you might see enough of that naloxone concentration that it competes with buprenorphine. Again, buprenorphine and naloxone might be competitive with one another, and it might potentially impair its response. So it appears to be an okay option in hepatic impairment, but you know, like anything else with hepatic impairment, it's always a cautionary tale. So here's some information. I'm not going to go through all the particular details of these next couple slides, but this is information that would be good for you to have close by about buprenorphine. So what we want to be aware of is that bioavailability. Okay. So we always compare it to IV. We're assuming IV is 100% bioavailability. What we know is our formulations go down dramatically after when we go through other routes of administration. So it's also important to recognize that bioavailability is 30 to 50%. That's being very generous when we say 50%. We know that the bioavailability depends also upon how quickly it's dissolving. Because when you tell a patient with sublingual buprenorphine, let it sit underneath your tongue, let it sit there for 10 to 15 minutes and dissolve all the way. Just think about that right now for yourself. Tell yourself, all right, I automatically start salivating. Just let it sit there for 10 or 15 minutes. Don't swallow. It takes me about 30 seconds before I want to swallow, right? So even though they do the best they can to let it dissolve, some naturally is going to drip down, and they're going to swallow some of that. So bioavailability also is associated with how quick it can dissolve. So being aware of its onset and its peak and duration are also important as we think about when we assess our patients. If you're going to give some IV buprenorphine, okay, it's a little bit different than our traditional full agonist opioids. You're going to give it, the onset is a little bit slower, 10 to 30 minutes. So if you're going to give it, you're not going to go back in 5 to 10 minutes and say, how are you doing, like with IV Dilaudid. After 10 minutes with IV Dilaudid, you know pretty good how they're going to respond to it. With IV buprenorphine, it's going to take a little bit longer. And you also see it can take upwards of an hour to hit peak effect, if not longer. So we have patients will go back in, we'll say, okay, how are you feeling in 30 minutes? I'm feeling a little bit better. We go back in an hour, I'm feeling a lot better. Now that slow onset, remember also a slow dissociation from the receptor means you can dose IV buprenorphine if you need to every 6 to 8 hours. Now, in acute pain crisis, we'll dose it a little more frequently than that, but you can get away with dosing every 6 to 8 hours, which is in the vein of that as well. So you want to think about that as we go through. I'm not going to go through all the different formulations, but recognize its onset and peak are going to be different than some of our traditional opioids for all our formulations. Okay. Now, the formulations in this slide here, the buccal and transdermal formulations, those are the ones that are FDA-approved for pain. Okay. The buccal is called Belbuca. All right. Belbuca is a formulation that comes in a lot of different strengths. We kind of think of it now a lot of ways to also use for our microdosing strategies. Okay. Just recognize Belbuca, if you're going to try to prescribe it long-term for somebody who's at home, insurance, oftentimes get in the way. The transdermal formulation here in the United States comes in low-dose patch strengths. It is available generically, and we have a little better success getting it approved, but the downside of that patch formulation is you cap out based upon how much they get. This is where Kyle and I are very jealous of our colleagues in other countries. They have patch strengths. Their lowest patch strength is higher than our highest patch strength, okay? Which is kind of silly, to be honest with you. They have 35 and 54 micrograms patches, which would compete with a moderate dose of fentanyl patch. That kind of give you a comparison. All right, I told you there was going to be a question coming on, and you all didn't believe me. All right, so I made this one easy for you. So I'll give you a second to read that and think about it. What mechanisms for pain relief of buprenorphine? So is A true? Yes. B true? Yes. C true? Yes. D true? Yes. E true? Yes. 5-star medication. Yes. Right? All right. So it's all of the above. But I'm not so nice on real tests. I don't give my students all of the above because that's just bad item writing. But yes, it is all of the above. Woohoo! All right. So we think about efficacy-wise, we know it's there. So what data do we have? Well, the data is mixed. The reality is, and we've grown a lot in the last 10 years, and I suspect the data to grow even more in the next 10 years. Okay? There are some helpful readings out there, and I suggest if you have time, you can look at those. There's a good Cochrane review from a few years ago that looked at buprenorphine. And what it suggests through various different study designs is that buprenorphine is an option for moderate to severe cancer pain. Okay? They don't suggest it be a first-line option, and I understand why, especially in 2018. We've come a long way from 2018 to 2021 with our understanding of buprenorphine. Okay, but they suggest it's an option to use for cancer pain. Not first-line, not second-line, but it is a consideration. Now, I'll tell you, I think clinically and what we've experienced at our institutions is it is first-line in certain situations, but we're getting more data to back up that we have to use it for pain management. So, what are some of the challenges with buprenorphine? Well, converting to and from buprenorphine is challenging. All right. Kyle and I aren't going to give you all of our tricks because this is job security for us. Right? This is how we keep our day-to-day livelihood. Right? But what we do know is converting to and from buprenorphine is tough. It's challenging. As my colleague and that I've gotten to know a little bit through the last couple of years, and friend Dr. Mellor Davis will say, buprenorphine's conversion factors are very favorable. Okay, they're very forgiving conversion factors. Translated, we really don't know what they are. Okay, so we've got some good guesses of how our conversion factors, and we have ones that we use clinically, but again, this might change over the years. For low doses, those doses approved for pain, microgram doses into low milligram doses, we use 100-to-1 factor. Buprenorphine is potent, right? For moderate to high doses, getting into the low milligram doses, so 4, 6, 8 milligrams and above, we're typically using more of a 30-to-1 ratio, maybe 50-to-1 ratio for those like 2-to-4 milligram kind of ranges. Okay, so this is the conversion factor we use. So the question I would pose you, now I ask you to think about is, A patient comes to you on Butrans patch, because you will get called on this. If they come to the hospital on the patch and they need help, you will get called. What's an appropriate breakthrough dose of morphine, and I'd say morphine in this instance, to give this patient? So I'd ask you to take a moment to pause and think about, what would I give this patient? So hopefully you take a moment to pause and think about that. And what we would appreciate is if we do a 100-to-1 factor, okay? So 10 micrograms over 24 hours is how many micrograms? I kept it easy for you, right? 240 micrograms, which is how many milligrams? Let's move the decimal place. 1, 2, 3. 0.24 milligrams, right? We use a 100-to-1 factor. We're going to take our right nice little decimal point and go, right? So 10 microgram buprenorphine patch is 24 milligrams of morphine equivalents. Okay? Now, what I like to think, how I think about it is, that is the morphine tolerance equivalents to buprenorphine. We appreciate that a 10 microgram patch will cover a little more than that from a pain response. And that goes back to each other mechanisms of action. If we think about it being somewhere between 20 and 30 milligrams of morphine equivalents, 10% of that would get us right around 5 milligrams of morphine, right? So that's where we'd probably start in this situation. So now a patient comes to you on Butrans 20 mics. They're going to be transferred to your hospital with increasing pain. Now I recommend a breakthrough dose. So I'll let you kind of do that all on your own to practice that math. But if I'm sure intuitive as you all are, we were at 10, just double the dose, good to go, right? But anyway, I'll let you practice that math as well. It's definitely a good math problem to do. So here's a good patient case for us to talk through together. You have a patient who presents to the ED in severe pain from new metastatic tumor burden. They have testicular cancer at stage 4, have a history of opioid abuse, depression, and anxiety. They come to you on buprenorphine naloxone 2 milligrams, or sorry, 8/2, taking 16 milligrams once a day. Your other medications are listed there for you. So, the question is, what is the best approach to manage pain in a patient who's taking Suboxone for opioid use disorder? And I can tell you with confidence, you are seeing this, or you will see this more and more and more. Even from a few years ago to now, you know, we're seeing it a lot more. And I can tell you with confidence how to treat this a lot more than it a few years ago. So, 4 or 5 years ago, I can tell you what would have happened. With a high level of confidence, bup would have been stopped, four agonist opioids would have been started, which is, maybe that it's okay, it's not the worst thing in the world. But what we have in this situation, we have data that suggests, more often than not, when that patient gets discharged, guess what doesn't get restarted? Suboxone. And that's an issue for the treatment of the opioid use disorder. Now, some rule changes have been put in place that allows clinicians to be able to prescribe Suboxone a little bit easier, right? But that's a concern. So what I would suggest to you that we do in this situation is treat up and above their buprenorphine with a full agonist opioid. Start a full agonist opioid and treat it as you were with like any other long-acting opioid. So the question is as to what dose, right? So you want to treat the pain. You want to use full agonist opioids at the lowest effective dose for the shortest amount of time period possible. Treat your pain trajectory as you normally would. Okay? Optimize non-pharmacological strategies. Are there opportunities to do interventional kind of treatments? Can we do things like radiation? What can we do to get that patient out? This is where also, in situations where we as a palliative care team will really press our team our primary team for non-opioids like NSAIDs. Many times NSAIDs just, our team's like, heck no, we're monitoring for fever, their platelets are questionable, no NSAIDs. And I come back, please, pretty please, I want some NSAIDs, right? I'm begging for some freaking ibuprofen. Let me have some ibuprofen, okay? But we'll kind of go through that risk-benefit as to why this individual patient, maybe we want to be cautious with full agonist opioids. But I'll tell you, it is safe to use full agonist opioids in this scenario. Okay? You want to do regular assessments because more often than not, again, you're trying to delineate, you know, that physical pain process through maybe some secondary gains through relaxations. Right? In this situation, you've got to be very, very careful. I'll be honest with you. What we will do is talk to our patients. How worried or concerned are you if we use a full agonist opioid? In fact, can you please tell us more about your history of your opioid use disorder? It helps us understand how to best treat your pain. Okay? We're here to help you, and I promise we're not here to judge you. This will help us understand. They say, you know what? Oxycodone. That's where I started. So I'd prefer if you not use oxycodone. Great. We used a lot of then. Okay? So getting that additional history will be very helpful. And then in most instances, you will continue the Suboxone or the Zubsolve, whatever it might be. If you have a patient who comes in, they've got newly diagnosed pancreatic cancer, they've got horrific pain, and your trajectory is going to be what for this pain pattern? Very likely, it's up and up and up and up and up, and they're already on 16 milligrams of buprenorphine a day. We're going to consider rotation at that point in time. Okay. So again, considerations for chronic pain. What's the trajectory going to look like? So in our patients who, for example, have head and neck cancer, okay, and your trajectory looks like this, right? They go through hell and back to get cure. They get cured. They get chemo. They get radiation. We will do very short segments of full agonist opioids. We follow up very closely. We do very intense monitoring. We do all we can to support them through that. And then we also taper them off very quickly, keep them under buprenorphine. We're offending agents, and we develop a plan, and we communicate. We often will communicate with their outpatient team, whoever the provider was initially prescribing the buprenorphine. More often than not, we think what happens when I'm calling, I'm like, hey, doc, this is Justin, the palliative care pharmacist from Ohio State. We have a mutual patient we're helping to manage. Unfortunately, Mr. Smith now has metastatic cancer, and we're seeing to manage his pain. I'd like to know, here we've got some options. How would you like us to proceed? What do you think almost always the answer is? You just go ahead and manage that pain. Do what you need to do. And then, hopefully if treatment goes the way we're hopeful for of, you're getting back down to where they are, just let me know when you're all finished. Please and thank you. More often than not, that's the situation we're in nowadays, which is good. So, contact provider, communicate openly, do what you can to assist that patient, develop that plan. Recognize that you might have to deviate from the plan. In some situations, be prepared to extend grace. Okay? Be prepared to extend grace. All right. And then obviously, you may want to consider contacting a pharmacist. I can't say everyone is open as Kyle and I are to buprenorphine and how it's used. In fact, there's one few times you'll see me a little less patient than I normally am is when I'm talking to a pharmacist who I just want to go to the store and smack around, grab their tie. Look, just listen to me. It's going to be safe. But it's for addiction. I'm like, ooh, gosh, okay. Just fill this prescription, please. All right? But sometimes a preemptive phone call will actually help out a lot. And if you're struggling, call us. Hey, I'm a palliative pharmacist. Thank you so much for your concerns about this patient's prescription. Here's why we're using it. Man, really, thank you for that phone call. Two thumbs up. But please fill it. Okay? All right, case two. Back to case one, again, I would have given that gentleman full agonist opioids, see where he was going, and we also would have taken the buprenorphine 16 milligrams once a day and broken up to 4 milligrams Q6 hours. Severe mucositis following transplant. The patient's taking buprenorphine 8mg/2 naloxone twice a day. Okay. They have now severe mucositis. Go ahead and use that strip sublingually, why don't you? All right. Now, sometimes patients are willing to do that, depending upon where the mucositis is and all that. But you can also appreciate why that might also cause increased irritation or potentially stinging. And also, the mucositis might disrupt the membrane and how much is being absorbed, and we really don't appreciate that. So the primary team is asking about giving IV buprenorphine. What are your next steps? Besides calling your pharmacist, right? Which is honestly, all kidding aside, these are the scenarios where in the morning in our huddles, we truly do sit down as a team, and we sit down and have some really good conversations. These are not straightforward. So we might ask, let's go talk to the patient. Are we able to give it sublingually? Like their sublingual formulation. Otherwise, we're going to start cranking out some complex math here. Okay? Second cup of coffee, second Diet Coke kind of mornings. Okay? We'll do some complex math and determine, can we even give enough IV buke to get there? Remember, the oral bioavailability is the sublingual formulation is about 30%. Okay, so we've got to start cranking out some math. All right? So what you're beginning to see is some of the complications of buprenorphine. Still five-star medication, but a lot of things you have to think about. Okay? So then we have a 74-year-old patient with new squamous cell carcinoma of the tongue, having moderate pain, trouble swallowing, hesitant to take opioids. This is a scenario we come across very often now. You know, I started practicing in this environment many years ago where we were just kind of at the tail end of this little bit of opioid phobia environment. Yeah, just the tail end. I'd heard of the word opioid phobia. Okay, and obviously that through the mid-2000s, it wasn't really an issue anymore. But now we have definitely gone so far, many patients, rightly so, are concerned about opioids. I don't want to wind up on that TLC show, living in the dumpster, looking for oxycodone, right? And that's what you will have patients literally say those kind of things to you, and you're like, okay, we can use them the right way. Well, you know what? I've got this opioid for you then. And it's medication that, in fact, it has decreased craving, has decreased risk for dependence. It's really effective, less side effects. We've got no option for you. This is that patient. Okay? So, again, we commonly deal with this where the primary team's like, no acetaminophen and no NSAIDs because their platelets are 17. They're on this really horrific chemotherapy regimen that we're monitoring fever. So, none of that. So, buprenorphine, right? So, if so, what dose and how do you counsel? I think that's some things important to talk about. Each formulation has slightly different counseling points. And those sort of things we'll do more and more together as well through some of our cases later. So case 4, you got advanced pancreatic cancer with severe pain, has a history of GERD and opioid use disorder, bup, 8-2, taking that 16 milligrams daily. This patient has completed all disease-directed therapy, soon transitioned to hospice. The team is requesting recommendations for this patient's pain regimen. Again, you will see this patient this year. I don't have any doubts you will see this patient. So what do you do? That's often the response we get when we ask the question in huddle. What will we do? All right? So this is, again, there are a lot of options here. Do we divide buprenorphine up? How well is it working? How well is it tolerating? Can we get them full agonist opioids? Is there a safe way to get them full agonist opioids? Is there somebody home to help that patient? If the answers are yes, yes, and yes, maybe we continue buprenorphine. Okay? If they're taking 8 milligrams twice a day or 4Q6, we're beginning to fold in some full agonist opioids, and their pain trajectory is just increasing. They're not a candidate for a celiac plexus block, and their pain is truly uncontrolled. Now what? We're going to rotate to our other five-star medication. our good old friend methadone, right? That's that consideration here. How do you do that? Very carefully. Okay. All right, so summary. Buprenorphine has unique properties that make it beneficial for use in pain management. Okay. It is a medication that deserves some attention when you're going to think about prescribing it. Dose conversions are not straightforward. And it's not the opioid. As much as I've pumped it up, it's not the opioid for everyone. It is a consideration for many of our patients, which are things you must consider before prescribing buprenorphine. So I thank you for your time and attention. I want to open up for questions.
So I was just hoping to add a little bit of the pediatric perspective with buprenorphine use, if that's okay. So it's even more complex, right? And there is much less evidence regarding safety, efficacy. There's definitely a need for a lot more studies in pediatric patients. I think initially when it was FDA approved, it was for ages 16 and older. So just keeping that in mind. And also there's a lot of complexities in pediatric dosing, right? As far as mgs per kg and how that impacts, perhaps the duration of action or even the clearance based on the child's organ function and body weight. So there's lots of more complexities in pediatric patients, and buprenorphine is probably much less used for that reason. Not that it's not still a five-star medicine, because it is, but there just needs to be a lot more studies about that in pediatric patients. And I think the last thing I'll say, thinking about practicality of the formulations available, is also something to think about in your peds patients, right? Because children, oftentimes a lot of their medications are liquid, and we heard a very poor oral bioavailability. So lots of things to kind of think about.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Lockman. And I'll piggyback on that. I'll tell you, in all honesty, when myself and a few others want to get buprenorphine approved on a high-C formula for other formulations, I kid you not, we sat around a table with our other pain specialist colleagues from surgery, acute pain, anesthesia, and thankfully, we as pharmacists at this had some of our palliative medicine colleagues behind us, backing us. Because I literally had somebody open a textbook and say, why would I want this on formula? It is an opioid, partial agonist, and it blocks opioid receptors. 5 years ago at Ohio State. And I'm like, the physician knew me well. It's like, because the response is going to come from this mouth, it's not going to be very helpful. So thankfully, they helped out. So what I would say is peds, that's where we are, right? We just don't know. And it's going to take somebody who's got a good understanding for it, going to be very conservative with dosing, and we're going to have to give it a try. But you're right. I would say that my confidence level will be a lot lower, too, in the pediatric population. So thank you for bringing that up. Other questions from the audience? All right. Either that effective or that unclear. Kyle, anything else to add? So as Kyle just insinuated, this was the highlights. And we could honestly spend several more hours going through these cases together. But I hope you appreciated that information about buprenorphine, and please do not hesitate to reach out. And thank you for your time and attention.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.